Executioners of England, William Marwood, Part 4. And the following year, in 1881, the most famous of Marwood's victims was Percy Lefroy, a youth who had killed a man named Frederick Gold by pushing him out of a train when Gold had resisted Lefroy's attempt to rob him. Lefroy was said to be in a state of collapse when he was taken to the execution chamber at Lewes Prison, though Marwood denied it. Quote, "When I tap a prisoner on the shoulder, he nearly always comes to me," said Marwood. End of quote. Dr. George Lamson came to him then 5 months later at Wandsworth, perhaps second only to Charlie Peace among Marwood's famed victims. He was a young and handsome general practitioner who had become a morphine addict while serving as an army doctor in the Balkans. Unable to maintain a medical practice for long, he took to forgery and other crooked schemes for making money. In 1881, he poisoned his invalid brother-in-law for gain, and it was rumored that he had similarly murdered another brother-in-law who died a few years earlier, though Lamson vigorously denied this. After he had been sentenced to death, there were several attempts to have him reprieved, and there were two stays of execution while arguments were considered by the Home Secretary. But Lamson eventually walked calmly to the gallows with Marwood on April 28, 1882, and earned the hangman's commendation for what it was worth. Quote, "The doctor died like a true gentleman," end of quote. Everything did not always go smoothly, however, even for a conscientious hangman like Marwood. When he executed James Burton in Durham, the slack in the rope caught the condemned man's arm as he dropped, breaking the fall and leaving the man hanging in the opening. He had to be pulled up and prepared all over again, and then pushed through the still open trap. This incident led in due course to the slack in the rope being tied up with a thread to keep it out of the way until the victim fell, when of course the thread broke and released the full length of the rope. A month after Marwood had hanged Lamson, the so-called Phoenix Park murders occurred in Dublin. The victims were Thomas Henry Burke, permanent Undersecretary of Ireland, and Lord Frederick Cavendish, Gladstone's newly appointed Chief Secretary of State for Ireland. The two men were ambushed by Irish nationalists that called themselves the Invincibles as they walked through the park together to the Viceregal Lodge. The real target of the assassination was Mr. Burke, Irish Catholic loyal, a person loyal to the crown, and a representative at Dublin Castle, and known to the Republicans as a castle rat. A gang of Invincibles lay in wait for Burke, and as he approached with his companion, four men leapt out. One of them, named Brady, drove a long knife into Burke's back. Lord Cavendish tried to beat the men off with an umbrella, but Brady stabbed him repeatedly, while one of his companions, a man named Kelly, cut the fallen Burke's throat. Long and careful police work led in due course to the arrest of 27 men, three of whom turned informers. At the subsequent trial, Brady, Kelly, and three others, named Curley, Fagan, and Calfrey, were all sentenced to death, all the others getting long terms of imprisonment. Of the informers, the chief prosecution witness, James Carey, who had been the leader of the gang, and after the trial was shipped for his own safety to South Africa, where, however, he was soon shot to death by an Irish nationalist named O'Donnell. Marwood traveled to Ireland to execute the five condemned men on different dates during May and June of 1883. He was accompanied by two detectives acting as bodyguards, for English hangmen were always, naturally enough, a personal danger in Ireland. It may have been his experiences in Ireland rather than in England that led him to lament his unhappy lot in social terms. Quote, "My position is not a happy one," end of quote. Once when returning from Ireland, Marwood had become acquainted with an Irishman on board the ship, spent most of the night drinking with him. A steward who had served the two men that night recognized Marwood on a later trip and asked him what happened to his friend. "Oh," Marwood said casually, "I've just hanged him." When Marwood fell ill and died in September of 1883, 3 months after hanging the Phoenix Park murderers, rumor, always looking for the sensational, had it that the Invincibles were responsible for his death. In fact, he died of pneumonia at the age of 63. He was buried in Holy Trinity Churchyard, close to his lifelong home, and they gave him a 6-foot drop. In his 12 years as executioner, he, more than anyone, transform death by hanging from a brutal and ignorant hit-and-miss affair into a procedure which at least had some semblance of humane technique about it. Ever since Marwood's time, the word instantaneous has been used freely of death brought about by efficient execution. But no one knows that such a death was ever literally instantaneous. The authorities like the public to think so. It took away some of the discomfort that might have been felt by the sensitive when reading the morning paper over their toast and marmalade. They were informed that a murderer had been executed and death was instantaneous. We need not take seriously Aubrey's tale about Sir Everard Digby, who executed for his part in the gunpowder plot in 1606, had his heart plucked out when the executioner cried, "Here is the heart of the traitor, thou liest." But there's plenty of apparently impartial evidence that people whose heads were chopped off in France showed unmistakable signs of awareness for a few seconds after their heads were severed from their bodies. No less than an authority than pathologist Sir Sidney Smith, professor of forensic medicine at Edinburgh University, went on record as doubting that death by hanging was really instantaneous, as far as the consciousness of the victim was concerned, since the heart would go on pumping blood and pulse would continue to beat faintly. It's certainly hypocrisy to pretend that the white hood over a victim's face was a gesture of humanity towards the victim. It was no such thing. By the time this was done, the victim had walked to the execution shed or chamber, had seen the hangman, had seen the noose, had been placed carefully on the division between the trapdoors and pinioned. All that remained to be done was the white hood was pulled over his head to adjust the noose. Matter of a second or two. If we had been that sensitive about the feelings of the victims, we never would have hanged him at all. The white bag was a gesture to the feelings of the necessary spectators. Sometimes, with a short drop, the head remained above the level of the floor or platform, visible to all. And even when it was not, those whose duty it was to look down into the pit, the prison governor, for instance, could be very upset if they saw the distorted features of a man they had come to know quite well. All we can say with certainty is that given the fact that men and women were executed, the long drop was an improvement over slow strangulation, and William Marwood's intentions seem to have been genuinely humanitarian, although there's a curious story about a visit he once made to Madame Tussaud's, where he had sat for his effigy to be modeled for the Chamber of Horrors. He was apt to call there when he was at a loose end in London and wander around with his old terrier that had caught rats in my business bags. One day, someone aware of Marwood's identity heard him remark that his dog was dying and said, "Why not hang him then?" "No, no," Marwood retorted. "Hang a man, but my dear old dog, never." Marwood's immediate successor was Bartholomew Binns, who had some experience of actual executions, having been an assistant on a number of occasions. Binns carried out his first execution at Wadsworth 2 months after Marwood's death, with his victim being one Henry Powell, who had murdered his employer's son. Binns also hanged Patrick O'Donnell, the Irish Republican, for the murder of James Carey, who was a chief witness against the Phoenix Park murderers. Binns' reign, however, was short-lived. His character was hardly what was required of an executioner in these days when any grounds for censure was liable to lead to demands for the abolition of the death penalty. On one occasion, Binns and an assistant, Alfred Archer, had been prosecuted and fined for traveling by rail without paying the fare. In March of 1884, Binns was criticized for an inefficient execution of Walton Gole of Liverpool when the victim's heart continued to beat for a quarter of an hour after the drop. The prison governor reported that, in his opinion, Binns had no idea how to do his work properly. Put the rope around the culprit's neck and hanged him, but it was by accident whether the hanging was successful or not. And clearly this man would not do, and another was soon appointed in his place, and that would be James Barry. Now, at this point, I am going to stop the series on English executioners, because we have reached the point we're in the mid 1800s, and it's more or less a recollection of various famous murders. And I'd rather go back and look at a different group of executioners. So the English executioners is going to switch and become the history of the Sanson family, the seven generations of French executioners, of which the one we're most going to be interested in is Charles Sanson, who was the chief executioner during the French Revolution. And we're going to go back and look at that and look at the difference in the customs between English executions and French executions and a variety of things that are going to go on. So I'll be using a book that's entitled The Legacy of Death, The Saga of the Sanson Family. And I also have a couple of volumes of the memoirs of one of Charles's sons, plus Madame Tussaud's eyewitness accounts and a variety of other books on executioners in France and Europe. It's a little more custom involved with that. But as far as the group that we have been studying, and some of these sources that I've used for the English executioners will continue. For example, our wonderful Encyclopedia of Murder by Wilson, Collin, and Pittman will continue. The History of Capital Punishment by Scott will also continue. But we'll be saying goodbye to The Hangman of England by Bailey, The Reluctant Hangman by Athol, and The Common Hangman by Blaud. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.